Let me ask you a question now that we're talking about the traditional alliances. I had an opportunity about a week ago to watch a JINSA webinar on the OPEC decision of Saudi Arabia. It was very interesting, the take that your former mentor, I suppose, who worked for the Department of Energy, was it? Or he was an energy analyst, you'll explain in a second. Very interesting, his take, which I think was very unconventional. And I know you wrote a piece about it that just appeared in The Hill, but maybe tell our listeners why you think they're getting this latest move by the Saudis to supposedly cut production, why a lot of people may be seeing this, in, I think, in the wrong way.
Yeah, thanks, Ron, on that. Look, we spoke about this in the last episode, and it's worth updating because this story has persisted in the last couple of weeks when the OPEC Plus, which is the OPEC countries plus some other oil exporting countries such as Russia, they got together, and despite the administration lobbying not to cut oil production, in fact, the administration reportedly even asked the Saudis if they could hold off cuts till for another month, which would conveniently be after the U.S. midterm elections, which is rather stunning, actually. Not only did they ignore that request by the administration, but they announced a cut of like 2 million barrels a day of oil, which kind of stunned everyone, certainly stunned the administration, and has triggered calls mostly by congressional Democrats and some administration officials for consequences, quote, against the Saudis, and calling the Saudis, calling this a betrayal, that they're colluding with the Russians by propping up oil prices, thereby hurting the Ukraine and thumbing their nose in the United States. So we did a webinar on this. It's the energy expert you mentioned is Larry Goldstein. I worked for him when I was in business school. He's been a mentor to me, somewhat of a father figure for a long time. And he's retired now, active. He was a co-founder of a leading energy consulting firm in New York, Pyra, and he's a leading energy expert. And his take was, look, this wasn't so much about the United States. His view was this was about two main things. One, slowing economic growth, which we see, obviously, globally. Chinese growth is slowing. U.S. growth is slowing. And therefore, economic growth, therefore, demand for oil is slowing. And so that the export countries had to adjust. Secondly, the cut. And then the other issue is it has not really gotten the attention that we wrote about, as you said, and my colleague Blaise Michel and I wrote in The Hill yesterday, and Larry talked about this, which was that there have been conversations with the West European countries and the United States to cap the price that they pay for Russian oil. And the Saudis repeatedly asked the administration not to do this. They apparently, the Saudis felt ignored. The Saudis, and we all know, that's basically they're historically a one-trick pony. Their whole economy and their geopolitical influence is derived from their oil production. And they feared that if this would be a successful cap on prices, if they could do it to Russia, they could do it to OPEC. So they said no, they drew the line. And that's what hastened the cut now, in addition to the fact that a cut was inevitable given slowing oil demand.
You mean they wanted to preempt a potential U.S. decision,
yes,
to form a buying cartel,
right,
with the Europeans?
Right, that's right. It's kind of a loose consumer, oil consumer cartel. And what made this, which the whole story is, first of all, the cut is really not 2 million barrels a day. And just to give context, global demand is about 100 million barrels a day. Because a number of the countries involved aren't able to meet their quotas, their production quotas, the cut is probably 500,000 to maybe 800,000 barrels a day or up to 1 million.
And also, I think the estimates of what was going to happen in 2022 was off because they thought that China,
that's right,
would need an extra, let's say, 500,000, but instead they've actually reduced by 400,000, something like that. So it's about 1 million shift. And I think there were a couple of other places where they were wrong about the demand because of a weak economy.
Right. OPEC had estimated that global oil demand would grow this year by about 3 million barrels a day, and the Saudis alone had already raise their own production by over 1 million barrels a day to meet what they expected. But that's not what's happened. Chinese demand has actually was expected to grow by, I think, 500,000 barrels a day, but it's actually declined by 400,000 barrels a day. So that's a swing of 900,000 barrels a day, just China. United States oil demand was supposed to, OPEC had forecasted something like 600 barrels a day, 1,000 barrels a day.
More.
More growth, and right. It's been more like 300, so half. So there's been, so they felt given their forecasts have been wrong, they have to start cutting production. I think it was particularly this focus on the cap on Russian prices that really had not gotten the attention by the media as much. So clearly, but that was clearly an important driver of the
story. How does that even, excuse me for asking this question, because I'm certainly not an expert on energy. And I don't even play one on a podcast, but how do you actually enforce a cap on the prices that you're going to pay for Russia? Because if they can get more in a market elsewhere, the amount more selling it to the Chinese or selling it everywhere, how is that cap even going to hold?
Well, the Russians have actually been, as far as I know, and I used to be a full-time energy commodity expert, analyst, but I gave up that day job a long time ago, so I don't follow it as closely, but the Russians have actually been able to sell a lot, not I think all their production, but a lot more than initially was expected because they've been discounting it to the Chinese and Indians and others. Basically, if the Europeans would get together with the U.S. and say, okay, this is all we're going to pay. I mean, the fear was, I can't assess whether it would have been successful, but the Saudis were afraid that it could have been successful. And then they don't want to see that. Certainly, they don't. It's not so much they didn't want it against the Russians. They're afraid of how it might impact themselves. But I think another thing in all this has been
preemptive strike against the buying cartel, yeah, as you said,
right? And we talked about this in podcasts earlier. This was seen by the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress is a real thumbing, the eye of Biden, because he went to Saudi, as we discussed in July. And one of the things he went to was asking for an increase in production. And I think in the next OPEC meeting, they agreed to increase production by about 100,000 barrels a day, which wasn't very much. And that was seen as a slight against the administration. But to actually now cut was seen particularly provocative. But the administration, as we just said, didn't appreciate the economic motive. And I'm not defending OPEC, obviously, but there was an economic motive for the Saudis. There was a concern about the cap. And also the fact is you have a U.S. administration, which we mentioned last time, which is also trying to manipulate supply by releasing the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for the last 6 months, on average about 1 million barrels a day, so that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is about the lowest level it's been in almost 40 years, since I think 83.
Let's remember that, it is true that Biden went there and tried to do, as we would say, some kind of sulha, some kind of rapprochement with MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. But let's remember, on a day two of the administration, they took the Houthis, that's who right. I think on their flag said, it says death to the Jews, death to America. I'm not even sure if it's death to Israel. It may be death to the Jews. They took the sanctions off them for no reason. The Houthis are in Yemen attacking Saudi Arabia. Then, of course, they called MBS a pariah. They said all of these terrible things. And then as the price of gas flew up before the summer and as the midterm elections are approaching, all of a sudden there's big concern. And rather than actually drill in North Dakota and do things like that and to actually, I think, unleash America's energy potential – they instead go to Saudi Arabia, go to Venezuela, I think, which we spoke about, to try to get more production. And if you're the Saudi leadership, you clearly see the United States as being totally transactional in their approach to them. But even more than that, remember, the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia is 75 years ago was on that, on that ship where you had FDR with Ibn Saud, and they met, and there was a very simple deal. Gas, oil, I should say, for security. The problem is when you're undermining Saudi security, it's hard for you to say you have to play ball with us on oil.
Right.
And they have undermined their security and their whole approach to Iran, which is the greatest danger that the Saudis feel. So that's why what I said before, if the U.S. administration and then the other European powers will get their Iran policy right, they're also probably going to line up Saudi Arabia and put them in the right position. But what the Saudis see is that on security, they've been abandoned by the United States. So why are they going to listen to them when it comes to oil? Now, you may be right, and the analysts, this expert on energy, which I found fascinating, those people want to watch the webinar, because I mean, he's really on another level when it comes to sophistication about the energy markets. It may be that this is an economic motive, but I would think that if they were dealing with an administration in Washington that was supporting their security with unwavering commitment to their security, and that was the messages that they were broadcasting both publicly and privately, I think that they would have probably done everything to have accommodated that administration.
Yeah.
I would think when Trump was, you know, a few months after killing Soleimani, my guess is if he asked the Saudis to not do a production cut, they wouldn't have done the production cut. Now, it might be that their motives are economic, but I don't think the United States had any leverage to change it.
That was your point, and I agree with you. And look, I find this whole thing, you know, just yesterday, Biden announced the release. They were going to stop this release initially, I think, at the end of October, but now they're extending it more into November. He explicitly rejected the idea that any of this is political, even though it's so egregious what he's doing with the SPR, with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. You know, this is prices, especially by inflation standard. I mean, this is, I don't think the whole purpose of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is to protect the U.S. economy in case of a major disruption or a disruption in supply. You don't really have that here. You just have higher prices. I'm not minimizing the impact of that, and presidents have manipulated this. But I think when prices were higher under Obama, he didn't play these kind of games. So this is really a flagrant, I think, violation. In fact, in my view, what he's been doing with the SPR is in some ways even more egregious, because it really puts American national security at risk. If there is a major disruption, let's say, for example, the Ukraine Russia war really heats up in a far more intense way than we've seen, or something happens with China and Taiwan and things like that, and you have really disruption in shipping and in the energy market, or there's a, by the way, you could have a, if there is a revolution in Iran, which I know it seems like that's what's going on now, but if this regime collapses, which I know we both want to happen, by the way, it's very possible.
And we're going to do a special diplomatically incorrect celebration.
Yeah.
We're going to do a celebratory podcast.
100%. Right? But, you know, by the way, when you have upheaval, political upheavals in oil exporting countries, it often historically leads to, I've looked at this, I think it was Ed Morris at Citibank that first put this, who brought this up, often leads to a reduction in oil prices. Production, by the way. So even though, of course, we'd want the regime to collapse, it's also possible to be disruptive to the oil market in the immediate way because of production. The point I'm saying is to lower your SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, so dramatically, I think it's over 40% of what it was last year or at the beginning of this year, I think is utterly reckless. And that is clearly being done for political reasons.
The strategic reserve, how do you remember offhand how many millions of barrels a day the United States uses?
Yeah. Our consumption, I think, is roughly, I don't know exactly, it's about 20 million barrels a day, I think. Roughly.
Really? That much? It's one fifth of the, no, it can't be that high. No, one fifth of the world supply?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's that high.
Okay.
It's about, by the way, the energy secretary, when she was asked that last year, she had no idea what it was. I think because she had no background. I remember watching the clip of that, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It's about, I'm just, while I'm talking to you, I'm Googling it. And it said last year was 19.9. So,
well, you're off, over. Mike. I mean, get your stats right before you're going to appear on a podcast. Okay, I mean, that's 100,000 barrels a day. That's a huge difference.
But that was last year, and we just said that oil demand has gone up 300. So it's 20 point something million barrels
a day.
Okay,
so 20 million. So, and then would they have to, the Strategic Reserve would have to make up for the fall, the shortfall in the production that you have domestically. So that's how right. long is that supply supposed to last?
Well, that's a good question. And there's been questions whether – I remember –
What was it? Is it like 600 million
barrels? It was over 600 million barrels a day, and it's 440 or something million barrels. By the way, oil is also
– Now, I mean, after they drew it down, it's about – they got rid of 40%. It's down to about 400.
400
something. So what is it – I thought I remember it being – it's supposed to be enough for a 90-day supply of the United States.
Yeah, makes sense. It's a good question what you need. It's also a very specific kind of oil, and not all refineries could use all oil. But the whole point is it's supposed to cushion the blow. By the way, other countries have tried to emulate this. The Chinese are way behind us on their strategic petroleum reserve, but they were trying to build theirs up.
Well, they've been buying a lot of Iranian oil, so maybe they've been stashing it. Now they're going to buy a lot of Russian oil. Yeah. You know, the good news for Israel is that we found that natural gas. And so much of our energy resources now are based on the natural gas, which we control, at least our shares, while we cede other parts of our economic waters to Lebanon.
I want to segue to that, but before we do, Ron, if you don't mind, I want to make one more point on this. I completely agree with you. We're saying this administration's policy, you know, as you said, they came in alienating the Saudis, pursuing a deal that existentially threatened the Saudi government or country, just like a nuclear Iran threatens Israel's existence. And there's such tension between the two countries that if things were much better, I think the Saudis would have handled it and hopefully would have handled it a little better. But I just want to add one other thing, because to tie into what we were saying before about the demonstrations, I think there's a real perversity in so many levels, of course, in the Biden policy towards Iran and Saudi Arabia. Just from a moral perspective, I think that you see this regime, what they're doing to these women. This has been a revolution or an uprising so far, demonstrations, but, you know, it seems like it's partly an uprising. They want to get rid of the regime. They're very clear about it. That's, you know, against women. The uprising is to protect the rights of women, against a regime that oppresses women with the hijab and other sort of restrictions, and then kills some of these women when they violate those restrictions. Meanwhile, you have in the Saudi government, I don't think MBS, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, gets enough credit for this. He's expanded women's rights.
Right.
I mean, we see it dramatically. I was talking to one of the retired U.S. generals involved with us at JINSA the other week, and he's a former senior military commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, and he was just talking about how he was in a cab in Saudi Arabia, driven by a woman. We're planning to go to Saudi Arabia next month. We're leading a group of retired generals and some of our supporters. And our main point of contact in the royal court is a woman. And apparently she's a real dynamo and extremely efficient. This would not have been that way a few years ago.
Right.
And while it's not, obviously it's not a democracy, there is no real democracy in the region outside of Israel. So I think you have to look at how these countries treat their women, how they treat the Jewish state. We've generally been, this administration has been coddling an Iranian regime that oppresses women and seeks to destroy Israel, while alienating our traditional ally of Saudi Arabia, which, while not perfect, and obviously we understand what they did to Khashoggi, has been expanding the rights of women while also warming ties with Israel. And it's hard not to see, given what you were saying also before, the utter collapse of this Biden policy of appeasing Iran, seeking this nuclear deal, while you have, and as you say, they would embrace it again tomorrow if they could, if the Iranians would show any interest, while you have the Iranians, supplying these deadly drones to the Russians, brutalizing women, and we're alienating the Saudis. And I think it's just a disaster of a policy.
Yeah, well, I fully concur. We have to find more issues that we're in vigorous disagreement with one another over. But is we had mentioned several months ago in one of the episodes, I spoke about this that famous essay by Jean Kirkpatrick on dictatorships and double standards, and how she explained how during the Cold War, the right policy was to work with certain authoritarian regimes who were actually opposing communism, because communism was definitely the greater evil. The only thing that was going to bring it down was going to be a revolution. And these other regimes could make the transition towards a more open civil society. And the regimes that she had mentioned then that were authoritarian at the time were Chile was one, South Korea was another, Taiwan. And you can actually see the prescience there that these regimes actually moved in a different direction. I think when you're looking at the Middle East, one thing you have to understand is who's the big enemy there and who's your ally. And when you look at which are the countries that are actually opposing Iran, which are the countries that are opposing an Iran that calls death to America, and which are the countries that are moving closer to Israel. And that should give you a good sense of who is on what side. And you're 100% right about the Saudis. The fact that the Saudis, we don't have an open peace with them, but as we've discussed, the invisible hand behind the whole Abraham Accords is Saudi Arabia. I'd encourage our listeners to go look at a map and see how an Israeli plane is going to fly to the Emirates without going over Saudi airspace, meaning they're enabling that peace to take root. And they were very, you know, the way they, when the peace happened, how they responded to it, their silence in that case was deafening in their support. So here you have a Saudi regime that is tacitly supporting Israel, of course, for their own security interests and economic interests. That's how countries operate. And that are doing things internally in Saudi Arabia to move it in a different direction. Now, it's not 21st century Israel. It's not 21st century America. But they've probably leapfrogged 2-3 centuries already from where they were. And you have this horrific attack against Khashoggi and this attempt immediately to rupture the relations with Saudi Arabia because of it. And now you have this one meeting that the, you know, the Saudis go to with Russia and then try to, as we said, preempt this potential cartel against them, a buying cartel against them, and make this announcement. And then everybody comes out of the woodworks and to attack Saudi Arabia with such vehemence and such hostility. I would like to see the same passion all these politicians have for against the Saudi decision that they made. I'd like to see that same passion to support the women of Iran. Because to support the women of Iran is fundamentally to support U.S. national interests. Its security interests, its economic interests, what it's trying to do in Ukraine, almost every single theater. And there, you see, relatively speaking, you see silence. And I don't know if the Saudi decision is really going to affect the price of oil this way or that way at the end of the day. And as we said, there's an easier answer to affect the price of oil for Americans, which is to drill in the United States and to unleash that energy. But the policy is messed up. There is a double standard in the wrong way. If the question would be, how can America support an authoritarian regime like Saudi Arabia or like some of these other societies, it would be an interesting question to have in terms of how you promote democracy long term, which is certainly something that I believe in.
Yeah.
But at least stand against your enemies. You can't appease your enemies and turn your back on your friends. And that's what happened with Saudi Arabia at the beginning of the administration, and it's what is continuing to happen today when it comes to Iran.